Christmas, Christmas, Christmas.
Well, it's Christmas time for the baby, and the snow is falling on the ground.
We wish you a shaped like Christmas, we wish you a shaped like Christmas, we wish you a shaped like Christmas, sorry for swearing so much.
I thought it was going to end with, also, Joel Silver is here.
What? Joel Silver's here?
No, it's... You know, it's...
It must be snowing.
So,
you know what the street value of all this snow is?
We are all dreaming of a white Christmas, especially Joel Silver. No, I did notice that the last time we recorded, I think you might have been fighting a cold. And every so often, just every so often, you hear this... And I swear to God, as I thought it was me doing a Joel Silver impression throughout the whole thing, I was like, oh, no, wait, no, it just worked out perfectly that as we're talking about Joel Silver.
I didn't want to bitch, but yeah, no, I totally was staving off a cold and just didn't want to be like, dude, I can't podcast. I might sniff every 5 minutes. Yeah.
Luckily, no. We have scotch to kill all of the bad things inside of us.
We have so much scotch.
And we are going to drink that
Speaking
scotch.
Speaking of which,
on this episode enough. Of...
Junk Food Cinema.
Brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com.
.com. .ho. Hey, I have a Christmas present for you.
A Christmas present?
It's like right here.
Oh, like for real? Oh, okay.
Holy shit.
This is for me?
Yes, Merry Christmas.
For those of you who can't see what I'm holding in my hand.
Which is everyone.
Which is to say, everyone. Cargill has handed me a box of Glenmorangie 18-year It even says right here, extremely rare.
Yes.
That is, wow.
This is one of my go-to scotches. If you've never had Glenmorangie 18, if you've never had the Glenmorangies, period, Glenmorangie's a wonderful company, one of my favorite distilleries, but their 18 is magnificent. So this is for you and your wife after you put the kids to bed to have a wonderful scotch and watch a movie.
Dude, that is very nice.
Three.
I had no idea we were doing a gift exchange. I would have brought yours with...
We aren't having a gift exchange. Oh, I'm giving you a gift.
That's very nice. Thank you. I'm going to get super fucked up on this.
Yes, so you are.
That is, man.
So, we're drinking the La Santa right now by Glenmorangie, which is their sherry cask, which is 12-year.
And you can only get it La Christmas because it's delivered by La Santa Claus. And we're starting early.
Yeah, but that's the 18.
Oh, wow.
So, it is one of my favorite scotches. It is good stuff. If you guys are scotch fans and have never had the Glenmorangie 18, it is a wonderful scotch, as are all of their double woods that they do. Their La Santa, their Nectar d'Or. They have so many great, experimental woods that they do, like, once a year, where they'll just be like, fuck it, let's try it in a batch of these barrels for a while. Those of you that don't know how that works, what they do is they take their 10-year scotch, and then they put it in a different barrel for 2 years. And the barrel is something that held something else. Like, this is sherry casks. So these were sherry casks that made sherry. The Nectar d'Or is done in Chardonnay casks. They have different types of woods for different everything. And even though it's the exact same whiskey, every single type tastes radically different, but in the best way. So I figured I would share one of my favorite scotches with you.
And I appreciate it. It's the only 18-year-old my wife will let me bring home. So I really appreciate getting that for Christmas. And this feels remarkably like the most classy we've ever been starting an episode. So let me just say, dick farts.
Dick farts.
Yeah, because otherwise no one's going to know what they're listening to. This is, of course, the Weekly Cult and Exploitation
Filmcast.
This
is the Scotch Cast, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.Scotch.
Welcome to the barrel-aged cast. Today we're drinking Glenmorangie to 12-year, but it's aged.
Today we're going
to
try... I've actually done Scotch podcasts where they literally just pull out four obscure Scotches and then ask us questions about them. And it's like, all right, that's cool, but... I'd rather talk about movies while drinking scotch, which we're doing today because it's been a rough day for everyone all around.
It's been rough. It's been rough. And hey, speaking of rough, why don't you go back and listen to our entire back catalog on iTunes as well as on Blog Talk Radio and Spotify. If you're tired of listening to your Bing Crosbys and your Dean Martins and your Mariah Careys during the holiday season, put us on that playlist as well. Just really fuck with your relatives if you're playing it through the Bluetooth speaker.
So I've got to share this with you. This past weekend, our good friends at It's the Movie Crypt, they did a 49-hour marathon. It was supposed to be 48 hours, but they were doing so well, and they were trying to... They said if they could hit $35,000 to save the Yorkies,
God damn it. I was told this was 48 hours. Now it's 49. Gosh, shit. Damn it.
It's funny that you go Nick Nolte because Joe Lynch went full Abel Ferrara all weekend. Like, his voice started getting raspy and he started doing Abel Ferrara impressions. It was fucking amazing.
That's awesome.
There was this great part where they had a litany of amazing guests, and they may have had a guest that did that directed Gremlins and Small Soldiers and
Piranha.
I got to they do you have any questions? And I'm like, I do. And I send in the question and I'm like, what's up with Barbara Steele's pronunciation of Piranha? And he just goes, you mean the only person in the movie who pronounced it correctly? So don't I feel like an asshole for the last 4 months?
No. I'm telling you what you should feel is pride, because that means this show and this show alone has been pronouncing the title of that movie correctly the entire time.
Piranha.
Badge of honor, but
so,
folks.
So Joe, being a big fan of the podcast, asked, you know, oh, are you familiar with Junk Food Cinema? He goes, I think I've heard of it.
You know what? I'll take it.
No, I haven't heard of it, but I feel like I probably should have heard of it. But so I'm going to pretend that I've heard of it, but I don't listen to it because I'm a very, very busy man.
I haven't heard of it, but you're a nice guy. So I think I've heard of it. I will fucking take it. That's on my business card. Joe Dante might have heard of our podcast.
That is going on my Twitter profile right now.
Patreon.com/junkfoodcinema.com. Dad, please help us. Joe Dante,
Merry Christmas, guys. So now you're here for. Mm. It's a black Christmas.
And this week, I have to tell you something. Usually we do movies for this show that we already really love, or it's a movie one of us is discovering. This is one of the rare instances where it's a movie I knew I liked a lot, I didn't know I was in love with until the second viewing. And that is, of course, The Long Kiss Goodnight.
What if you couldn't remember your real name? Your first kiss, or your last goodbye.
I don't remember.
And then suddenly, all your memories...
Name's Charlie. I'm coming back.
...came flooding back to you.
Evening, Charlie. Long time.
One bullet at a time.
I got movement on Samantha Kane.
Good.
I may have a lead on someone. They still have some of her stuff.
This man, he's gonna help me find some things out, so we'll be safe.
Your full name is Charlene Elizabeth Baltimore.
This could be trouble.
My name is Samantha Kane.
No, forget all that. You're an assassin working for the United States government.
We have 24 hours. We find her, and we kill her.
Run for your life!
Charlie Baltimore's alive, sir.
Who are you?
Name's Charlie. The spy.
If you have plans for a calm, quiet evening, it's time to kiss them all. Good night. Gina Davis, Samuel L. Jackson, The Long Kiss. Good night. Directed by Rennie Harlan.
This is going to cross off a few boxes for us because we are rapidly approaching the point where we've covered everything Shane Black has ever touched.
Yes.
We are also approaching... covering a significant portion of Rennie Harlan's catalog.
Well, let's just be blunt and say we're approaching the point where we've covered everything good Rennie Harlan ever did.
This is correct.
Because there's a lot of not so good Rennie Harlan out there. And this is in that era where it's in the sweet spot of him, where he's being handed great material, and he's got such talented people working with him in such a way, people that... 10 years later wouldn't go near a Rennie Harlan movie. But at this point, when you talk about the cast, I mean, the cast in this is one thing. We're going to talk about, you know, the titans that are in this movie. But the people behind the camera on this movie, when you just talk about who the screenwriter, the director of photography, and the director are, it's like, holy fuck, how is that not a movie I watch all the time? And this is one of those movies that the talent on this is insane.
It's nuts. And it unfortunately comes out in, like, you want to talk about the zeitgeist ruining a movie. The time period this comes out in is so unfortunate for so many reasons from so many angles that I feel like most people forget that this movie even exists. For example, Rennie Harlan Immediately prior to Long Kiss Goodnight, makes another movie with star Gina Davis.
Oh, no.
A little movie called...
Cutthroat Island?
One of the biggest bombs of all time at the time.
Holy, I have seen Cutthroat Island so many times on the big screen, it's not even funny.
I have seen Cutthroat Island so many times, I've played the Super Nintendo game.
Yeah, no, I was doing the Rocky Horror Picture Show back at this period of time. This is something I did. For those of you that don't know my back history in this, I did the Rocky Horror Picture Show for about 5 years. I've performed in it somewhere over 500 times. I was a crowd hustler. It's where I met my wife. She came with her friends. I ended up hitting on her there. Ended up going very well. But a substantial portion of my life from late high school on through college was spent at the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and it was at the Fox Theater in San Antonio, Texas, which is no longer there. It's a fucking parking lot. They destroyed it. They built strip centers nearby. I can actually go and visit and stand on the parking lot where once I performed in front of untold thousands of people over the years.
And he'll still do it there in that parking lot.
Oh, every Saturday night, Friday and Saturday night, 10 p.m., Rocky Horror Picture Show in the parking lot.
Rocky Horror parking lot.
Rocky Horror hand jobs in the parking lot, $5 a person.
You know, you joke, but you just created someone's college thesis, right? You just created a film school thesis without trying.
So when Cutthroat Island came out, it almost immediately went to the dollar theaters and stayed there for a while. And so it would be running on Friday and Saturday nights before Rocky Horror. And I would sometimes, I'd be bored. It was the 90s. The internet didn't fucking exist.
Right.
Even if at this point it did, it barely existed. It wasn't very good. It wasn't usable by most people. You know, it was, they're just, the 90s was a dearth of things to do compared to what you have today. And so I'd be like, fuck it, I'm just going to go and catch a movie. And there, during this period of time, there wasn't a lot of stuff playing. And holy shit, Cutthroat Island. And I was like, fuck it, I'll go see Cutthroat Island again. Because I would walk in and they, you know, the crew working there would wave at me, but hey, Gargoyle. And they would just let me go watch whatever I wanted. And so I saw Cutthroat Island probably like half a dozen to a dozen times. And I swear to God, having seen it half a dozen to a dozen times, I remember one moment in that film and couldn't tell you another goddamn thing about it.
Yeah, it's not memorable, you might say.
I remember the cannonball going through the back of the ship, and that's it.
It's interesting, we're talking about Long Kiss Goodnight, and when you're trying to recount the details of Cutthroat Island is when you have retrograde amnesia, because you know you've seen it, but that's about as far as it goes.
I don't remember anything else. I know I must have had a life before I washed up on the shore, having seen Cutthroat Island 12 times, but I don't remember anything that happened.
Sure. No, absolutely. Yeah, so what's unfortunate about the situation surrounding Cutthroat Island is that it bleeds into Renny Harlin's next movie, The Long Kiss Goodnight. Now, meanwhile, Shane Black had, prior to this, sold a script for a movie that I love to death, that I'm still trying to get Cargill to come on board for, The Last Action Hero. Of course, this is after The Last Boy Scout, which we've covered on the show. It's a Junk Food alum. And Shane Black was reticent to get in bed with this team of Renny Harlin and his then-wife, actress Gina Davis, because of the failure of Cutthroat Island. But New Line and good old Bobby Shea over there at New Line was just chucking money. Just chucking money at Shane Black to get him over his hesitation. They got the price for this script up to $4 million.
Let me stop you right there, because Shane has told me the actual version of this story. And it's not that you're wrong, it's that the public version of this story is one thing. The other version of this story is another.
Is this the kind of thing we can share?
Oh, yes.
Okay, all right,
yes,
fair enough.
Because this is something that Shane shared with me and a couple other writers over drinks many years ago. In which he's like, somebody said, how the hell do you sell a script for $4 million? And he goes, I'll tell you the secret. The secret is you find two studio heads who fucking hate each other, who just hate each other so much that they can't let the other person have a win. And they'll just start throwing money to prevent the other person from having a thing, even if they have no interest in it.
So was that Bob Shea and Joel Silver?
It wasn't Joel Silver. It was one other studio head. And I can't remember if it was DeBonaventura who was running. Okay. I want to say it's the guy before DeBonaventura.
Running Fox, you mean?
No, Warner Brothers.
Oh, okay.
Or it may have been someone over at Fox. But whatever it was, whoever was had it out for Bob Shea, who these two guys hated each other, they bid this fucking thing up. And so he played it. Shane played it as, hey, you know, I'm hesitating because the last movie, yada, yada. He knew exactly what he wanted to do. But he also was smart enough to know, I can make a lot of fucking money if these two knuckleheads butt heads over this thing. And they did until he had a record-setting $4 million bid on this fucking thing.
Right. And which is very shrewd, and there's nothing wrong with that, except that it gets out in the press. So suddenly there's a lot of negative press around, can you believe they paid Shane Black this much money? Then there was some real, like, kind of hatchet pieces written. One of them, specifically for Variety, called Script Fee Vomits Upwards for Mayhem Meister, was lamenting the fact that Shane Black was a writer of violent Hollywood schlock and was overpaid. And
what are you telling me, that Variety writers in the 90s were writing shrewd hatchet pieces? I'm shocked.
Thank God they
shocked to discover
there's gambling in this establishment. Thank God they course corrected, right?
You know, you'd never see a hatchet piece like that in the press today, talking shit about a filmmaker for their success.
And what's insane to me is that the finished version on the screen versus the original script was so much more violent, and yet they're complaining that the actual theatrically released movie was too violent. And I'm watching this movie and I'm thinking of not only Shane Black's oeuvre, but the 80s action canon at the time. This feels pretty tame in comparison.
You would think, but there's a couple moments in this that when you highlight them, don't feel like they belong in that type of movie at the time. Like, you and I watch so much fucking horror that a person getting a needle put in their eye and then seeing that person later having been horribly scarred, that's like, yeah, no, that's typical action storytelling. And it's like, not in the 1990s it fucking wasn't.
I guess that's true. I guess, but I think of the scene immediately thereafter where that guy confronts her again. And even, like, when she breaks his neck, they pan so far up that she doesn't even really do anything but move her arms.
No, but he gets hit in the face with a pie, a la the Three Stooges, and the pie shatters, and we get blood coming out of his face. Like,
which, by the way, must have been...
Yes, them looking away while she snaps the neck was very, very tasteful.
Look, it must have been a titanium berry pie, because that fucker goes down like a sack of potatoes the minute he gets hit by that pie.
That Corel wear is not fucking around, dude. Like, that shit is designed to take extreme temperatures, and she fucking shattered that thing on the face. Having gone to the plant where they make that stuff is not playing around. So the very fact that that breaks makes me cringe every fucking time. Yes, by the way,
side fucking bar.
Sidebar. My parents are from upstate New York, and the city, is it Corel? What is it called? The company that made all that glass.
I want to say it's Corel. I think it's Corel, but whatever it is,
the city is named that after the plant, and after the company. And they have a plant where they make all the stuff, where they have a large science museum, and they teach you all the science of manufacturing and of glass. And so it was on the way to where my grandparents lived. And so three or four times in my life, my parents are like, hey, we're going to stop at the museum you kids like. And we're like, yay. And they had like a kids museum where you learned all about the manufacturing of glass and did all the kind of stuff that cool kids museums fucking do. Mm-hmm. Like, I was never bored going to the glass museum. It sounds like the most boring thing on the planet.
Oh, yeah, it does.
But it was fun as fuck. As a kid who dug science, I was like, fuck yeah. Because they show you how they make it, you know, how to melt sand and do all sorts of stuff, and they would have little games and neat things, and my mother would always get to buy a new cool piece for the kitchen, and it was fucking awesome. And so, but you also see all the crazy stuff they build with it, like aircraft stuff, because they're also a company that makes glass for fucking aircraft. They show you how to make bulletproof glass and cool shit like that. And so, you know, that stuff is durable as fuck. And so seeing that get smashed on someone's face is makes me fucking cringe, like, because it's like, wow, that fucking hurt.
I know there used to be woods around here, but now I can see these damn trees.
I think this is going to be a full-on sidebar episode. I don't think we're going to get to
we'll
this
get
movie.
There, but I'm going to, what's the opposite of one-up? Because I'm about to do that to your story. Because you used to go to the Corel Glass Museum as a kid, which, in comparison to where I went as a kid on vacation, sounds like fucking Disney World. When we weren't going to fucking Disney World, we went to places like the factory where they make longer burger baskets. Do you remember this craze in the 90s, the longer burger baskets? They were basically just wicker baskets that had different swatches of fabric inside of them. And it was like, whatever it was with Tupperware parties in the 80s, longer burger parties, it was this huge fucking thing in the Midwest. Everybody had to have, my mom had 1,000 of these fucking baskets. We went to the factory where they make them, and the front entrance is shaped like a giant basket. Jump to 2018, the company has gone completely under, and they are having trouble, as you might imagine, selling that property, because what fucking company wants to come in and have a building shaped like a goddamn wicker basket? Like, it's like Mike Brady's architectural designs from the Brady Bunch movie. It's like, it's a giant fucking basket, and nobody knows what the hell to do with it. So that's where I went on vacation as a kid. Like, you start to understand why I run for the comfort of entertaining action movies like Cobra and The Long Kiss Goodnight. Stargrove. The Long Kiss Goodnight revolves around Samantha Cain, played by Gina Davis, who at the beginning of this movie is, she is your quintessential PTA mom.
I'm in the PTA!
Then quit!
She's just living the small town life. She's Mrs. Claus in the Christmas Parade because it's a Shane Black movie, and we got to tell you within the first 10 seconds that it is, in fact, a Shane Black script. So it opens with Elvis's Santa Claus is back in town, and we're going down the Christmas parade, and a bunch of local teenagers are like, Mrs. Claus is hot! Woo! And we start to realize that there's something is rotten in Denmark here. There's some kind of life that she doesn't know about, because she tells us she has retrograde amnesia, and that 8 years ago she washed up on a beach in Jersey and doesn't remember anything about her life before that.
I mean, to be fair,
if
you ever find yourself in Jersey, it's best if you don't remember why you're there.
Yeah, you don't want memories coming with you if you're found on a beach in Jersey. I think
much love to those of our listeners who live in New Jersey.
But I do think it's why those kids drink so much. If you've ever seen that reality show.
There's a reality show set in New Jersey?
No. Don't worry about it. So this is at the same time we are introduced to a character played by the great Samuel L. Jackson named Mitch Hennessy.
One of Sam's greatest fucking roles.
And in the pantheon of Shane Black private investigators, one of my very favorites.
He is so fucking special in this role. Mm-hmm. Like, this is, and the thing you have to understand is at this point in time, this is just the beginning of the Samassance. Like, this is, you know, here's a guy who had been struggling, who had been showing up in films for years, was given small roles. You know, was always doing small roles. And then Jungle Fever came along. He became briefly celebrated. But, you know, the rest of Hollywood's like, yeah, we don't know what to do with this guy. Like, he's just an aging black actor. Like, what the fuck? But Quentin Tarantino sure as fuck knew what to do. Tony Scott sure as fuck knew what to do. And Rennie Harlan sure as fuck knew what to do.
I'm going to tell you a little story about that. So one of the best, and we're going to jump ahead a little bit here, and this is a spoiler alert.
Listen to a story about a man named Sam. Poor about beer, barely kept his family ham.
Barely kept his family hard as a motherfucker. Though you heard it here first.
Hey, honey, this is a real big fucking gun.
This ain't no ham on rap, pal.
What the hell are you doing?
Saving your life. I would have been here sooner, but I was thinking up that ham on rye line.
during this movie, and this is a big spoiler if you haven't seen it, one of the greatest fuck yeah moments of any movie in any decade is when Samuel L. Jackson comes driving that car out of that truck saying, "You can't kill me, motherfucker." Apparently, his character, Hennessy, was supposed to die in the original draft of this script. And they originally shot it. He dies. And during a test screening, people revolted. In fact, one person apparently stood up and said, "You can't kill Samuel L. Jackson in a movie. What are you doing?" Which is funny that the very next time he works with Rennie Harlan, I think they were playing with that expectation a little bit. I feel like you would maybe
suggest. Which Rennie Harlan movie might that be, Brian?
I'm not sure of the title, but it's his deepest movie. It is his bluest movie.
Is it the one where his hat is like a shark's fin?
Maybe. You know what? I could get on board with that description. It is, in fact, Deep Blue Sea that we covered not but a few weeks ago. And
I feel like all we need to do now is, like, in January, we just need to do Die Hard 2, and we're, like, done with Rennie Harlan. It's just like, sorry, that's every movie he ever made. No, we assure you, that's every movie he ever made.
I kind of like Cliffhanger.
You do.
I do.
You do like Cliffhanger.
It's one of my favorite Die Hard knockoffs. And, I mean, if for no other reason than we get John Lithgow's amazing... Anytime you get Lithgow as a villain... Go see that movie.
Again, we're talking 1990 to 1995 is like this window of awesome Rennie Harlan.
It's not a window many people are escaping through at once. It's a small window for sure. I mean, Die Hard 2 is 90, Cliffhanger 93, Long Kiss Goodnight 95, Deep Blue Sea 97. And have a nice day. Because after that, you have Driven, you have Mindhunters, you have one of the two Exorcist prequels, you have...
Yep, say it. Say it out loud. I want to hear you say it.
The Covenant.
The Covenant!
And then Clinger.
I love the Covenant. There's a reason why I've never forced you to cover the Covenant, though.
Cover the Covenant? Why aren't we covering the Covenant?
Well, because I love it. But I love it for all the reasons that when you actually sit down to watch it, you're going to fucking hate it. Like, it's...
Yeah.
There's a... It's a magical, magical movie in
which... Well, there's a lot of magic in it.
In which one scene...
Ill-defined magic.
...involves a woman walking in to take a shower in the ladies' shower section. And she is the only one there. And it is this wonderful, longing scene that keeps hinting at the fact that she's going to drop the towel at any moment. And does not. And that we instantly, almost immediately cut to the men's shower where there's 40 men all hanging around, leaning on the wall, bare ass fucking naked. You have never seen that many male asses, even if you played sports. And it is the most oddly uncomfortable scene of who the fuck hangs out in a locker room like that, that just kind of melts your fucking brain. Sure. It's like, what am I watching? Like, what is this thing? And then it just goes off the rails in all the best ways.
So when he says Harry Potter can kiss my ass, he means
he
actually can because it's out all the time. My ass is on view.
No, he says, fuck Harry Potter.
No. During the scene where they're ripping off the Lost Boys, he goes, Harry Potter can kiss my ass. Or at least that's in the trailer, because
the trailer is actually, like, there's a shot in the trailer where they make their magic blow a girl's skirt up and she's wearing panties. Not in the movie, she's not.
And apparently if you listen to the commentary, there is a long discussion about casting that girl. So, way to go, Rennie. Way to go, man.
I'm going to make you my weotch is the cherry on top of the shit sandwich that I adore so much.
That's a weird junk food pairing for that episode, cherry on top of a shit sandwich, but yeah.
That's the Covenant, and I fucking love it.
Take a drink of
so
shit.
So maybe this isn't the last Rennie Harlan movie we talk about.
I'm putting that in the maybe category, but coming back to the movie we're actually talking about. Back to the lecture at hand.
We're never getting through this movie, and you know it.
I know, we're definitely going to try. On this viewing, really tuning my ear to the Shane Black dialogue is what
made me fall
head over heels for this film.
This movie, this is Shane going full Shane. Like, that's the thing.
He's really shameless about it.
You can see why this got bit up so high. Imagine reading this dialogue on the page. Everyone is snarky. Everyone is funny. There's some classic fucking shit in there. Like, this is why you never make an assumption.
Everyone knows when you make an assumption, you make an ass out of you and umption.
Yes.
You know, there's so much great back and forth. There's so much snark. Both in the playful scenes and scenes between, you know, with tension where these people hate each other and they're essentially telling each other to go fuck themselves. It is just so good. Shane's dialogue here is fucking top notch. In fact, of this era, it is the sharpest dialogue. Like, the, in terms of script, the dialogue is better than Lethal Weapon. It's better than Last Boy Scout. Like, it's better than everything he's got going on at this time. The only thing you can compare it to is his movies from 2006 on, from Kiss Kiss Bang Bang through The Nice Guys. Like, it's that, like, it's, this is Shane Black learning what his voice is, and then ultimately coming back to that voice years later and becoming the defining factor of his writing.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that 100%. I mean, you have so many elements in this movie that become staples of his. The way he writes private detectives, the way he uses kids in movies, which that's really the thing that impresses me and fascinates me the most about Shane Black movies, is when you go all the way back to Monster Squad. I mean, one of his very first big jobs is writing this movie where most of the cast throughout all of the movie, you are going along with kids. And the way, and I remember us talking about it when we talked about Monster Squad, the way they talk in that movie, there is not a false note. No. In the conversations they have, there are problematic things, but they're problematic because that's...
Because kids are fucking problematic. Kids are
fucking problematic, especially when they're entering their teenage years and they're filterless and they have no concept of political correctness. All they know is the things that they've heard on TV and movies and what makes them cool. The currency of cool is so much more important than being PC to a child.
Well, it's an interesting thing that I've heard put forward by a number of psychologists in talking about like video game language. In how there's a couple of really awful words that you hear all the time if you go on Xbox and things like that out of kids. And they're not saying it because they're racist or homophobic or awful. They're literally the worst words they know and they think that will offend you. And they're not sure why they're offensive because they haven't really gotten to the point in their life where they understand exactly 100% what those words are and what the history of them are, that they just know that it's the worst fucking thing. And so that spills out and they call some 40-year-old pasty guy with a beard the N-word, who's just sitting there going, really? That's what?
Yeah.
Serious? You fucked my mom. She's like 64, dude. Like, what the? I don't understand why a 13-year-old wants to fuck a 64-year-old. Like, none of this makes sense to
me. You may need a few more Fortnites to grow up, kid. That's all I'm going to say. It may take you more than a few Fortnites.
That was a clever play on words, my friend.
Thank you. It must be the whiskey talking because you just gave me a compliment.
That wasn't a pun. That was a play on words. It was delightful.
Fair is fair. But yeah, I really am interested in the way, because almost every Shane Black script has a child character that is super important to the plot and presents so much opportunity for a young actor.
Also, one of Shane Black's hallmarks, precocious as fuck.
Oh, so precocious.
I mean, let's be honest, we've never really met 13-year-olds as mature as the 13-year-olds he writes, whether it's Iron Man 3, whether it's Last Boy Scout, whether it's what we'll talk about next week, The Nice Guys. He writes these very adult children who are taking care of their fuck-up fathers, usually, or their fuck-up father figures, like in the case of Iron Man. And that is a very... very big hallmark of Shane Black movies, but not here. This is very different. This is a little girl who is very much a little girl who doesn't understand what's wrong with mommy, which is a very interesting thing for Shane to play around with, because it's not something we've ever seen out of him before or since.
Do you think, I mean, I'm starting to come around on the idea that maybe Daniel Harris is the best in all of his movies that feature precocious kids. I mean, Monster Squad is kind of its own animal because the entire cast.
You know that I have a deep, abiding love of Danielle Harris my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to the point that, for those of you that haven't heard this story, I once ran into her in person at a horror convention and just could not talk to her because I was just so, like, my friend Angela Bettis is just like, well, just go talk to her. And I'm like, I can't talk. She's Danielle Harris.
I can't. Oh, because of the restraining order.
No, it was just, you know, when you grow up as a teenager, like, you know, with a, you have that long, lifelong cinematic crush on someone your age, like, that there's so much youthful angst tied into that. Like, it's not even like as an adult I could be like, oh yeah, no. Yes, when I was 14 years old, I thought you were the world. It's
please get your hand off me.
Yes. It's you feel fucking 14 years old again and like, no. But yeah, so, but no, I would argue, you know, that, you know, I love Danielle Harris. Rewatching The Nice Guys this weekend, we'll get into her next week,
okay.
But she's really great and she's a great character. She doesn't have that snark that Danielle Harris has.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, she has a heart that Danielle Harris doesn't have.
Interesting.
In that movie.
Yeah,
and that's also all that stuff's on the page. It's not just, but both those girls gave amazing performances, and we'll get more into that next week. But back to the movie that I assure you we're never going to get through.
We're definitely going to try. So, Hennessy, I want to talk about his 9-to-5 because he is a private detective who is pulling some shit.
He is the worst of Shane Black's characters in terms of awfulness. I can't think of a character in a Shane Black movie who's a protagonist that is worse than him. Like, he is how Gay Perry sees himself.
Yeah.
Like, this, he is, Hennessy is the guy that Gay Perry thinks he is. And that I'm not a nice guy, I'm this awful guy. Hennessy thinks he's a good guy that just kind of pulls some scams every once in a while. And he's not. He's a terrible guy. In fact, you will see echoes of Hennessy in another private detective in a movie 20 years later that we're going to talk about next week, The Nice Guys. Like, there's echoes of what Sam Jackson is doing in this movie and how this character is that shows up in Ryan Gosling's character in The Nice Guys.
Yeah. And so the scam he's pulling in this movie is,
what's one of the scams?
One of the scams. The one we actually see is that he has a woman on staff who pretends to be a prostitute who, you know, gets into bed with wealthy gentlemen.
Wealthy married men.
Wealthy married men who he can then bust in and arrest, quote unquote, for prostitution. But I understand how something like this could really be detrimental to you, so maybe we could work something out. He's just fucking extorting money from people. That's what he's doing.
Yes.
Like, he's not so much a private detective as he is just a flat-out crook.
Yeah, he is fucking scamming these people.
Yeah.
Hard. And in a way that he doesn't get caught, and he knows he's not going to get caught, because who's going to report to the police that he paid off some police officer that busted in on him for prostitution?
Yeah. Yeah, it's the nuclear option where, you know, you can't report on me or you will go down as well.
The beauty of that scene, like, there's so much great dialogue in that scene, but the beauty of that scene is he looks at his own employee and says, judging by the taste in your prostitutes, I'm guessing you're not a rich man.
Yeah.
And it's like, fuck, dude.
Dick.
That's
move.
Cool. And you, like, see the look in her eyes where she's just like, God damn it. It, like, this is embarrassing enough that I do this for a living. You've got to say that shit.
Yes, and I think the icing on the cake is the fact that the two cops who bust in with him are two homeless guys that he paid.
One of whom vomits,
and he asks one of them to read him his rights, and he's like, you have the right to silence. Like, he just, like, has no idea what the Miranda rights are.
No, he knows enough having heard them as a drunk hobo.
Right.
But not nearly enough that he could recite them.
Right.
And it is a hallmark scene in that movie. It is one of the great Shane Black character introductions. Like, I would be hard pressed to find a character that was introduced better than Hennessy is here. Like, meeting him, we know he's a piece of shit right away. And so watching his redemption as a character throughout the movie is actually really worthwhile. I mean, that is a theme of Shane Black movies, is we are offered people who do awful things that then get redemption. And that will be seen again. See, the reason I keep mentioning this, the reason I'm so happy we put these together, I feel that out of Shane Black's movies, as much as Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and the Nice Guys are thematically similar. Long Kiss Goodnight and the Nice Guys have so much more in common in terms of pure DNA.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I would agree with that, having watched both of them kind of back to back. In fact, another thing that was very interesting was revisiting this movie after, you know, it's been a couple of years, revisiting Total Recall, because they share a lot of similar story structure. The whole concept of you had a cover that you got so deep into and then something happens and the cover became your life is essentially the through line of both of those films.
And more to the point, like, I'm so angry you brought this up, because I was like, I'm going to bring this up.
I'm so angry.
It's going to be so clever. And I'm like, oh, God damn it, we both arrived at the same point. Fuck. I'm not so clever at all.
See?
Did you hear that, Brian? You're not so clever.
Yeah, we have another glass.
More scotch. it's more than just that, because the thing that they really share in common in terms of their DNA is that... both of them reject their former identities. Right. That's the whole thing, is their former identities are fucking superheroes. They're the things we all dream we could be. Charlie is a fucking super assassin who scares the shit out of any man that hears her name. Like, she is a fucking badass. Like, you do not fuck with Charlie. Charlie is fucking the shit.
She was the Atomic Blonde before Atomic Blonde.
Yes, although technically 20 years after Atomic Blonde, depending on where...
And also technically not a blonde at all.
Not a blonde at all. you know, you've got that. You've got, God, what is his name from his former name in Total Recall?
Oh, Quaid, it was Hauser.
Hauser.
Yeah.
Hauser is... I mean, Hauser's the number two. He's the lieutenant. He's the badass. He's the guy that Richter kind of hates because he's above him. That's why Richter has it out for him in Total Recall. Like, he's the shit. But both of them reject that for the goodness that's actually inside of them that their former selves repressed.
Right.
And those are really fascinating narratives. The idea of redemption through amnesia, the idea that once you strip away all that awful stuff that made you awful, that you really could be a good person deep inside, and that when those two people are presented against each other, that ultimately the goodness would win out. That's what both of these movies are about.
Well, it's like, on a primal subconscious level, would Clark Kent choose to be Clark Kent instead of Superman? Like, that, I find that really fucking interesting, just the idea of, like, my other life affords me all of this power and privilege, but it's not really what I want out of life.
But it's more like if Superman woke up one day and discovered that he had been General Zod.
Yeah, there you go.
And then had come to Earth and lived life as Superman, and General Zod started reemerging, and who would win in that mental fight?
Right.
And it's, in this story, it's Superman. And that's the thing, is that both Quaid and Samantha?
Yeah.
Yeah, are the characters that, those are the personalities that went out over these super strong alpha fucking assassins and killers. And it's a really fascinating thing to have come from two different movies so close together, written by two amazing different writers. You've got Shane Black here, and of course Total Recall was written by Dan O'Bannon, who of course is a fucking legend. So both of those, and both just are really great fucking movies. But that theme, it was really interesting rewatching the movie this time, where I'm like, this movie's just Total Recall.
Yeah.
Like, it's Total Recall where the sidekick, where it's just gender flipped.
Yeah.
Where instead of having this woman who's trapped with Quaid, it's this private detective who's trapped with Sam, you know, and it's really interesting to see two very similar films that have very different takes.
Yeah, no, I agree 1,000%. I do find it fascinating that I have seen this movie multiple times and I never put together that her name is Samantha Kane, Sam Kane, which is an anagram of amnesiac. Never fucking put that together. Like, it, and I probably never would have if not for the IMDb and the tireless work of our research team, because it's not like you see just Sam Kane written on a paper somewhere for you to figure it out.
Do you read Samantha Kane?
Do you read Sam Kane? holy shit, what if this is another story by Sutter Kane? What if this
we're gonna,
is
we're
also...
going to find the Sutter Kane multiverse. It's gonna, it's going to be that Tommy thing from fucking Saint Elsewhere, where it turns out that most of our entertainment really all is written by Sutter Kane.
I also feel it's appropriate because I think there might be a lot of people out there who would describe you and I as the little kid from the end of Saint Elsewhere. So yeah, that probably works.
Yeah,
out.
I think that's appropriate.
That tracks. Also, speaking of headcanon, are we not going to talk about the fact that her handler in this movie, where she is a former assassin with amnesia, is Brian Cox? Really? We're not going to make the headcanon assumption that this was Treadstone before Treadstone? He's fucking borning it all over again. This is pre-born.
I was under the impression that this is what he did after he worked with the local police force.
Wait a minute. In Super Troopers?
I mean, if we're going for headcanon.
Okay, so... Wait.
I want to watch you put this together.
So he starts his law enforcement career with the Rhode Island State Police, somehow gets promoted to the CIA, and is running Treadstone within a few years.
Does that not sound like a Broken Lizard movie to you?
Here's my $11. I want to see that fucking movie. Don't get me wrong. The Brian Cox story, where every chapter is broken up by him pronouncing the names of scotches that you and I will drink while recording the episode.
Have you not put together what tonight's episode really is?
Is it
do you
my
know what
memory?
Brian? Do you know what Brian Cox does on YouTube?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. He pronounces the name of scotches
that's
that
right.
we drink during the episode.
That is what
that's
tonight
his thing.
Is.
That's his thing. It's just so
whenever and if you ever want to look like the cool guy at the bar before you order, look up on YouTube Brian Cox and the name of the scotch, and there will be Brian Cox sipping a scotch, going Glenmorangie.
For the rest of this episode,
Glenmorangie.
I want you to just randomly do that. Just randomly drop in pronunciations.
Boona Hobbit.
Which is actually not one of the names of the mutants in Total Recall somehow.
No. Boona Hobbit is a wonderful scotch.
Also didn't realize until recently that the guy with like the hatchet face of the mutants who tells him like, you got a lot of nerve showing your face around here, Hauser. And he's like, look who's talking. That's fucking Dean Norris from Breaking Bad. I, like, never fucking put that together.
It's because half of his face is literally covered by a prosthetic.
This is true, and he wasn't playing a cop, so just went right the fuck over my head.
Well, that's what's gonna fuck with everybody on Hellboy. Like,
they're
gonna watch Hellboy and, like, who is this? I've never seen this guy before. Who is he?
Well, Hellboy's
gonna... He's a dirty cop.
Hellboy's like, I'm not a cop. And it's like,
I'm not
no,
a cop.
We know.
You're a cop. I'm not a cop.
You're a demon. I'm not a demon cop. Okay, fine. Great. Why do you keep insisting upon that? We already knew it. If you're gonna give any kind of, I guess, credit to Bob Shane New Line, you do have to admire...
We have to give a lot of credit to Bob Shane New Line.
Well, just, I mean, in the fact that, you know, they threw all this money at Shane Black to get him over... The idea of like, yeah, we're going to do this despite what happened with Cutthroat Island. At least they were pushing the idea in the mid-90s of doing action films anchored by actresses.
Well, not only that, like this is one of, if this were a movie released in 2018, people would be like, oh, look at this. It's led by a woman and, you know, it's a woman and a black man in a movie together leading it. And all the white guys are the bad guys. Like, that's how, I mean, the thing is it was a very progressive movie at the time that was really taking a lot of chances, but also geared by the fact that both of these people were stars at the moment. Like, Sam was coming up. Sam Jackson had two big hits under his belt, and Geena Davis, even though Cutthroat Island had bombed, was a huge star.
Yeah.
So, this is a no-brainer in 1995. 96.
95.
And it is, yeah, but it is one of those films that you watch today, and it's really frustrating that this was a movie we got in the 90s, and we're like, fuck yeah, we're finally getting movies like this. And here we are, 23 years later, and people are still like, fuck yeah, we're getting movies like this, because we haven't gotten enough movies like this.
Right.
But again, both of them are like crushing it in this movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, in a way that it's like, how is this not more of a thing? And I guess box office, because I know this movie didn't do huge, but God, they are just, they're killing it. And that's the, in order to go to the rest of the cast, you go to Brian Cox, and that's it. You've never heard of anybody else in this fucking movie.
Lafroig.
Yeah, which is unfortunate, because there's one cast member who I think is so good in this movie and had a shot. Like, he was in a lot of things in the era, mm-hmm. but it just didn't really ever come together, and that's Craig Bierko.
Yeah.
As
I take that back. David Morse is in this for like 5 minutes. He is. David Morse is awesome.
David Morse, 5 minutes in any movie, is fucking awesome.
He really, like, dude, CQ, small moves, Ellie. Like, that, if you don't like feel something in your heart, just thinking of David Morse talking to Jenna Malone in fucking Contact, like, you just, you're made of wood, my friend, because that's pure tear jerking dad material right there.
Yeah, David Morse
is, and every time David Morse showed up in the 90s, I was like, yeah, it's David Morse, and everyone else was like, who? And I'm like, you love this guy, and then he shows up, oh yeah, that guy.
And full of just as much pathos was the 5 minutes he was in Drive Angry. So, you know, there's that as well. I fucking love Drive Angry.
I know you do.
Oh, I love that movie so much.
I know, I need to revisit that, because I did not care for it, but I know you've brought up Drive Angry. Like, there's many times somebody messaged us recently and said, what are the Nick Cage movies I need to watch? And I mentioned a bunch of movies, and then you mentioned a bunch of movies, all of which I don't like. I was like, oh God, these are all the movies and I'm like, oh God, he really does love Drive Angry.
Everybody's got their own vintage of Cage, and my vintage of Cage just happens to be the uncaged Cage.
And I you know, I dug deep too on one that is not a popular Cage, and I went with Guarding Tess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I think I mentioned Firebirds.
You did, and I felt really conflicted about that, because Firebirds is not a good movie, but I kind of love that you recommended Firebirds.
I love that
we're in the middle of Nicolas Cage, and he has nothing to do with this movie.
Oh, yeah, Stargrove. So, Craig Bierko plays this nasty fucking asshole, which is the other thing I love about...
Really nasty.
I love about Shane Black movies is the character who isn't necessarily the big bad, but is so bad... That, like, for example, we have the character in The Last Boy Scout, and I can't believe I'm blanking on the actor's name. I always want to say it's Bronson, but it's not Bronson Pinchot. It's the actor who I always get confused with Bronson Pinchot, who's, fuck, you know who I'm talking about.
No.
It's Taylor Negron. So Taylor Negron in The Last Boy Scout is so fucking vicious and awesome.
How do you confuse Bronson Pinchot and Taylor Negron?
Hairlines. I think they had similar 80s hairlines. I got nothing else for you.
I guess I just, both of those guys are touchstones in their own way to me.
Yeah.
That, like, there's, each of them have their own several things that I love that they've done that I can't confuse them.
To be fair, you also couldn't remember Taylor Negron's name, so touchstone might
be... I could not remember Taylor Negron's name, because when you say, guy I always confuse with Bronson Pinchot, Taylor Negron would not come up. Had you said the pizza guy in Fast Times, or the liquor store clerk in the Stoned Age, it would have been like, Taylor Negron? Fuck yeah.
Oh, it's, you know who I was thinking of when I said Bronson Pinchot? It was Lee Marvin. So that's on me. I get those two confused.
Put a little sour cream on that baked potato. I fucking love Taylor Negron. He was taken way too soon. What a talented motherfucker that guy was.
Absolutely. But
anybody order a pizza?
Right here, dude.
I love, you know what? Because he's gone, I'm going to take a second to memorialize that motherfucker. He used to do shows where he would show up for Fast Times, and they would show Fast Times, and the thing would break right at the scene where there's a knock on the door outside the classroom. And the lights would come up, and everybody would be like, what? And then Taylor Negron would walk in the costume, carrying a pizza, go, anybody order a pizza? And the crowd would fucking lose it.
Love
and, like,
it.
Talk about taking a single walk-on role and turning it into something cool that you would do regularly. Like, it was just what a... And his stand-up was funny, and he was just always a good character actor. But, okay, so Taylor Negron in The Last Boy Scout...
is another example of Shane Black just writing these really scary sort of henchmen, sub-big bad characters. And I think Craig Bierko does a great job as a former enemy and former lover of Sam Kane, who, by the way, we haven't even talked about the fact that she gets her memory back in one of the craziest hit a deer on the highway scenes I've ever seen this side of Tommy Boy.
It starts with getting groped by an old man.
Yeah. Which is the other Della Reese show we don't talk about.
The drunk old man who, you know, does a little, oh, little grab. I'm sorry, I'm the old dirty man. And then when she looks up again, there's a deer in the road, hits the deer. And in true great golden age Rennie Harlan fashion, that scene's fucked up.
Yeah.
Like, there's this deer trapped in the fucking windshield, kicking around, gashing the face.
Yeah.
Like, it is pure chaos. It is what everyone who's ever hit a deer describes. Like, that scene is nightmarish in its execution. And she swerves off the road and hits a tree.
And both her and the deer are ejected from the car.
Launched from the car.
And she starts having these flashes of this other person, this other life, these memories.
In the most 90s part of this movie. Like, this movie, in other terms, is vintage in all ways. But the weird CG of the dreamland where Charlie starts like, I'm Charlie and I'm coming back.
Yeah.
Is really fucking weird.
Oh, not just the visuals, but I mean, Alan Silvestri does the score for this movie. And I really, what I noticed about.
What?
Yeah.
For a Joel Silver movie?
I'm just saying.
I'm shocked.
Alan Silvestri has this amazing thing that he does, that his scores are like perfect accordions. They can be as big as you need them to be to announce the most iconic thing in the movie and really create some fanfare, or they can be so small, like the smallest. And the way I described it is, it can, from one scene to the next in one score, describe a meteor the size of Earth that is going to destroy it, and the stars billions of light years away that are just twinkling behind it, like simultaneously. It's amazing when you really like listen to an Alan Silvestri.
That's a beautiful metaphor, man.
That's not what you hear in this flashback. What you hear in this flashback is like a fucking Hans Zimmer electric guitar gone crazy. It's like Don Simpson's alarm clock. Like, it's just like... Like,
it's a little over the top.
It's super fuck. I thought I was watching Curse of Michael Myers. I was like, why are these fucking random guitars coming in here?
Whoa.
There's so much random guitar in Curse of Michael Myers.
Yeah, but that's... No movie deserves that. Especially not a good one like this.
Sorry, I meant to say I thought I was watching the producer's cut of Curse of Michael Myers. Does that make it better?
No, it doesn't. How dare you, sir? How dare you invoke that even close to this movie?
Podcasters do that.
I know.
Which, by the way, is one of my favorite parts about this movie is when she starts...
Chefs do that.
Where she's cutting up the carrots so fast. She's like, give me more things to chop. And then, like, they all, like, start having fun with it. And then she takes a tomato and throws the tomato and the knife at the same time. It sticks to the wall. And her family's just looking at her and she's like, chefs do that. And it's like she doesn't want to admit that there's something violent in her past. Now, Hennessy comes into her life because he was hired at one point to find her, had given up on it, and then there's a break in the case. And
kind of.
He may have been hired by her.
No, he was hired by her. The thing is, and again, this is one of those great subtle Shane Black things, we find out that he doesn't give a shit about this case. She's amnesia chick. Nobody remembers her name.
Yeah.
He doesn't remember her name. But his assistant, who plays the prostitute, is on top of fucking everything.
And so to speak.
And, well...
including the men that he extorts money from.
So,
your witness.
She's actually gotten the lead on the case. Like, this thing comes up. She's kept an eye out for it. She follows up on the lead. She hands him the information as Princess Exposition, going, hey, by the way, we found amnesia chick. And here's all this great information about her. And which sets up all of the rest of the movie. Like, movie is so tightly written.
Yeah.
That in that scene, we're given all of the red herrings, and we believe them ourselves.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And he comes into her life right about the same time as this convict known as One-Eyed Jack. Known as One-Eyed Jack because she fucking took his eye.
She took one of his eyes.
I mean, you know, cross my heart and hope to die, stick a needle in that guy's eye, because that's exactly what she did. And he breaks out of prison when he sees her on TV in the Santa parade.
No!
It's super...
No!
It's like fucking...
It can't be!
It's like Solomon Grundy in a cell, just like,
He's a Batman villain for like 2 minutes. Like, no! And he starts banging on the thing. And it's so important that we keep focusing on her that apparently the news has like 12 shots of Mrs. Claus.
Yeah.
Just so that he can keep beating on the bars.
And he breaks out.
Like, no!
comes.
Can't be.
He comes after her with a, speaking of Total Recall, a future shotgun.
He's a little over the top.
What's with the future shotgun?
You mean one that hits the wall and blows like a 6-foot hole
and
in the wall?
And it's blue. And it's blue. Why is the explosion blue?
I couldn't even begin to tell you.
It's really, I'm like, is that one of the Total Recall guns? And I'm just confused about what I'm watching right now.
That, how you first, like, this is one of the weak spots of the movie. Like, the movie's great.
The wall.
And it doesn't matter that it's, no. It's not something that fouls up the movie, but it does make me sit here and go, there's a slightly better movie here in which we actually see One-Eyed Jack get out of prison and wonder why he's getting out of prison. How he fucking accrues a fucking gun from Total Recall and then shows up, figures out exactly where she is and shows up at her house.
Yeah.
Like, he is just used as kind of a mindless thug. And it's like, why did you go to that extent? Like, why do you have the guy in prison that does that? Why does he have to be in prison? Like, you literally set up a much better story that you don't pay off. He could literally be a guy sitting at home watching television and sees that. And he's like, what the fuck? Like, he doesn't have to be in prison. Nothing she did got him arrested. He got arrested for a total other thing. Like, we literally have to have lines of dialogue to explain why this guy was in prison and then broke out of prison and have to wonder how he broke out of prison, how he found her, and how he accrued a very special gun.
We skip a few steps.
We skip a few very interesting steps. And it's like, this doesn't need to be this complicated. And it being this complicated doesn't make it a better movie. It makes us wonder, what's going on here? The only reason he has a future gun of some sort is so that he can blow a hole in the side of the wall so she can pick up her daughter, throw her through the wall into the treehouse, and we get to see for the first time that there's something weird going on with her because we have not seen the super heroine in her yet. Like, we have not seen that until she picks up her daughter and chucks her across to the treehouse, and we're like, what? And then it's like, oh, shit. And then goes and has this really big fight where she kills a man with a pie.
Yeah, because fuck yeah. And so this leads them on a road trip because Hennessy has a postcard that she apparently wrote to a fiance, talking about a fiance that she has that she didn't know about. And she's just really desperate to figure out who she used to be and what this life was. So she leaves her family, goes on the road with Hennessy to track down this fiance. Here we have our unlikely team because it's a Shane Black movie. He is one of the absolute kings of the buddy movie. And the two of them together are so great because, man, Samuel L. Jackson, the quips that are just flying out of his mouth with expert. It reminded me, actually, one of my favorite parts of this movie that reminded me why I love it so much is when he's in the hotel room. What movie is he watching? What movie is he watching on the TV?
Oh, well, in The Long Kiss Goodnight, he's watching The Long Goodbye.
And I about creamed myself. I was like, that's my fucking favorite movie
of all
time.
It really is.
And I adore it. And one of the
things, have we not covered The Long Goodbye?
I don't know, but don't worry. That'll be rectified in 2019. Bet your goddamn ass on that.
Yeah, you know what? Now that we say it out loud, that's a movie that I'm ashamed. Like, I never am like, we've got so many movies to talk about. Why? It's like, dude, you found time for fucking No One Lives. And you haven't done The Long Goodbye yet.
We did an entire Patreon episode on Tracks.
We did a whole Patreon and No Long Goodbye, like one of the greatest detective movies ever made. Probably Altman's best film.
It is Altman's best film. It's everything.
I don't know, man. There's MASH. We'll talk about that when we get there.
And this is related because that movie is everything that Robert Altman is. Much like The Long Kiss Goodnight is everything that Shane Black is.
This is true. It is not everything that Rennie Harlan is. There's
no.
Like, the thing is, this script is so good, it elevated Rennie Harlan.
It made Rennie Harlan look good.
There are moments where you see the definite Rennie Harlanism. Like, there's a couple great shots of blue screen so bad, if this were in black and white, it would look like a movie from the 30s. Like, it's it's that kind of, like, you it takes you out of the movie and you notice unnecessary special effects.
Yeah.
Like, why didn't you do that practically? Well, because we had blue screen. It's like, no, it wasn't there yet. God damn it.
And I feel like there are moments where if it weren't for the dialogue, Shane Black's dialogue, you'd be like, what the fuck? Like, the climactic kill where she's flying up a string of fucking Christmas lights because Shane Black, and she goes up just in time to take the gun off of a dead policeman also hanging on them to shoot the guy out of the helicopter, and he's falling onto a bomb truck, and she goes, "You die screaming," which is a callback to an earlier line, and you're which like, that fuck line, yes!
But that line is so perfect and brilliant where it is, because it's like, there's the it's the moment where he locks her and her daughter in a freezer to freeze them to death, and she just goes, "You're going to die screaming," and you're just like, "I believe," and then she goes, "Tell me, am I lying?"
Yeah.
And it's that moment, because that's been his through line the whole time, is he can tell when someone's lying, which has been what we haven't gotten around to, is what's so fascinating about the character is that that actor's performance, he's always so tickled every time he realizes that Samantha has no idea who the fuck she is. He's just always like, she has no idea. Like, he's just always like, oh my God, she really has amnesia. Like, she really thinks that she's some fucking suburban house mom.
Yeah.
She has no idea she's one of the world's biggest badasses and that everyone that hears her name shits themselves. Like, the president shits himself when he finds out that she's still alive. I thought you said she was dead. Like, oh my God, the president knows who she is and wants to know why the fuck this mess is being left at his door. Also, I've got to admit, that's another thing I love about this movie, is you have a president who's confronted with somebody else's mess. And he's like, I don't want to hear it. I want nothing to do with this. Clean it up.
Yeah.
Because he's not corrupt.
No.
And he wants nothing to do with anyone else's corruption and doesn't want to be complicit in having heard about it.
He's actually a fairly progressive president because he tells the guy, oh, you want to know where your funding is? I'm putting it in healthcare.
Yeah.
Go fuck yourself.
Yeah. Also very 90s.
Man, your uncle is going to hate this movie. And I'm talking to all of you. Your collective uncle.
All of our uncles.
Is going to hate that line. I tell you what. By the way, Craig Bierko, who looks like if somebody went back to a 90s Kevin Smith movie and forced Jason Lee and Ben Affleck into one person.
No. No.
Yes, he does.
No. He looks like he was the Flash's stunt double on the original Flash TV show.
He looks like... No, let's play this game. He looks like a guy who turned down the role of Chandler in Friends before Matthew Perry got it. Oh, wait, that's because it actually happened.
I believe, I was like, wow, that sounds a little too on the nose.
That is why, I mean, that's kind of why his career petered out.
I was just referring to the fact that he looks like Jonathan Shipp. Because he looks like fucking Jonathan Shipp.
Hey, ask film Twitter. Go ask film Twitter. But
go ask film Twitter.
We need like a whip sound effect at the end of that, like it's fucking Rawhide. But so while they're on the road together,
go tell it on the mountain. Go tell it to film Twitter.
Hashtags everywhere. So while they're on the road, they cross paths with Bierko, who immediately tries to kill them. A great Rennie Harlan moment of them running away from an explosion down a hallway.
Wait, whoa. No. There are three times in this movie they outrun fire. This needs to be pointed out that it was the 1990s, and for some reason, everyone who made movies believed fire was a thing you could outrun.
Look, I'm not... That doesn't negate the fact that it happens here.
Oh, it happens. It happens a lot.
And then they shoot through a window, and my favorite, most Rennie Harlanist moment in this whole movie is that she starts shooting down into a frozen lake and somehow breaks it just enough.
Which, by the way, they set up beforehand where they show the sign, do not walk thin ice.
Okay. I guess my problem is that you'd still be fucking dead, because it's not, one, if you hit water from that height, it's not a good day for anybody. You're going to have a bad time.
It was a third story.
If you hit water from that height, you're going to have a bad time.
It was a Rennie Harlan movie.
There it is. But they don't even fully break the ice, so they still hit solid matter. And I'm just like, this is it's still a Rennie Harlan movie. As much as it's Shane Black's movie, and Shane Black is the reason that this is a good movie, it's still very much a Rennie Harlan movie.
The scene at the end where she cuts the Christmas lights and goes flying
out,
that's a Shane Black moment. Like, that happens in almost every Shane Black movie. Like, there is a moment where the movie has gotten so ridiculous that we believe the hero can do so. I mean, we just talked about this last week on Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, where he's making fun of that stuff, where he bangs on the coffin and the gun falls into his hand and he shoots the final of 14 guys. Mm-hmm. Because why?
There's always 16 guys.
It's always 16 guys.
I didn't count in this movie. It might have also been 16.
It might have also been 16 guys. But so it's that. Like, I buy that. Shane Black didn't write scenes where anybody outran fire.
No, absolutely
never
not.
A thing.
No.
Like, the thing about Shane's movies is they're always so fucking grounded. Even when they're big, they're fucking grounded. Like, the violence is always very small. And Harlan was just like, no. I guarantee you this is a Harlan note.
Oh, of course.
I guarantee you in Shane's script there was a way that they got out of there in a different way. And no, Harlan was like, no, we need the stunt to be bigger. I've got an idea.
One of my favorite grounded moments in this movie is when she, it's a simple thing where she just catches up to the tanker truck. This is the plot that's revealed, which is
eerie
because
fucking eerie.
The plot that's revealed is that the head, is he the head of the CIA or just the head of this particular program at the CIA?
He's the head of, I think, this particular program at the CIA.
He has determined that they are not getting enough funding, which is set up by the president's line, and that the last time that they got the last time that something happened that increased their funding was this bombing of the World Trade Center, which happened in the 90s. And that afterwards it came out that maybe the CIA knew about it and all this other stuff.
And hadn't done anything
about
it.
Hadn't done anything. So he figures out that if there is another major terrorist attack, that maybe people will start listening and they'll get the funding that they need, which she calls a fundraiser. So it's clearly something they've run before. And I think the insinuation is even that the attack on the fucking Trade Center was a fundraiser.
Yes, the original, and keep in mind, this is the 1993 attack.
Yes.
Because this is what's so weird is when this movie came out, this seemed very, like, these numbers were very weird. They're very strange. They're trying to kill about 3,000 people. They killed 4,000 people.
Yeah.
I rewatched this movie on 35 with Shane at the Austin Film Festival 1 year. And it was after 9/11. And it was a very weird rewatching of the film because it was something that had not crossed Shane's mind was, Oh, shit. Because at this point, you know, early aughts, it was very widely accepted that the government had foreknowledge.
Well, I mean,
and if they didn't have foreknowledge, that they were involved. Like, whether you believe that or not, whether, you know, jet fuel can't melt steel beams, or whether you are like, yeah, no, that's ridiculous. This was something that was widely, openly talked about on the early internet. It was one of the big conspiracy theories. So watching a movie in which, you know, half a decade before Shane Black wrote that exact plot, it was a little weird. And he mentioned was complete fantasy, and that was something that could never happen because that's the third act of that movie is all ridiculous things.
Yeah.
Like, that's just what the movie is. The movie is, in true Shane Black fashion, starts just getting fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because that's what he likes. Like, he likes to have a nice grounded movie and then just go fucking nuts and have fun with it. Because, guys, we're watching a fucking movie, and this is what you want out of a movie.
But the key to the plan is this truck that's going to explode with the body of a dead, frozen Arab gentleman in the driver's seat.
No. No, the Arab gentleman is put in another car that's going to be found 5 miles away. That he's going to be responsible for leaving the truck there, and that they're going to drive the car, and the guy's going to be found dead the next morning, having frozen to death in the car after the car accident. As he's driving away from where he left the tanker to blow up.
Now, what ends up happening is when Gina Davis gets out of the freezer with her daughter, she instructs her to run, and the daughter goes and hides in, unfortunately, the toolbox under the semi-truck where that is the bomb. So there is a
dumbest kid in a Shane Black movie ever.
Not on the ball, this one. So she is chasing...
Not like, can you think of a dumber kid in a Shane Black movie?
In a Shane Black movie?
Yeah.
No. In a Christmas movie?
Well, maybe, yeah, Jake Lloyd? I mean, Jesus Christ, yes.
But Jesus Christ is a dumber kid in a
Shane
Christmas
Black
movie?
Even the 5-year-old in fucking Monster Squad.
Yeah.
You know.
Don't be chicken shit. Yeah, I love that kid. But so she's having to chase down this truck through what? A Christmas parade. Because of fucking course this movie begins and ends. It is bookended by a fucking Christmas parade. Shane Black!
We wish you a Shane Black Christmas. We wish you a Shane Black Christmas. We wish you a Shane Black Christmas. Sorry for swearing so much.
It should be every year. The grounded moment that I was talking about is she rips the driver out of this truck and just throws him on the ground. No big deal. But then later he radios in to Timothy, to Bierko's character, and is like, yeah, she got the truck and she messed me up real bad. I think I'm dying. And he picks up the radio and he's just like, continue to die over and out. But the fact that like that fall from a moving truck, which didn't look like anything, and he's pretty sure he's dying, that feels pretty fucking grounded. Because I'm like, he could have punctured a lung. He could, like, there's a lot of things that could have happened in that fall. And the fact that they choose to go there when some of the other moments are so cartoony feels like Shane Black trying, like to keep a wolf at a door, like to keep this movie grounded. And I love him for it. And I think that's the reason why it's elevated and why it is the best Rennie Harlan movie, is because Shane Black is there.
You think this is the best Rennie Harlan?
I do think this is the best Rennie Harlan. As much as I love Deep Blue Sea, this is the best Rennie Harlan movie. Like, I think just from a critical standpoint, absolutely. Even though Ebert didn't care for this movie, he referred to it as listening to popular music on the radio where you get 10 minutes of a great song and then 90 minutes of somebody just talking in your ear. And I'm like, I don't think it's poorly paced, but at all. Like, not even a little bit. I think every moment that you're not in the action is spent on such great character development. Like, when she finally embraces Charlene Baltimore, which is her, I guess, her real name or her operative name, that scene is so fucking great. There's a moment where she, like, she's like, let's get drunk, and she drops. She does this trick with a shot glass that I've never seen before, where she basically rolls it from one side of her face, takes it, and then rolls it out the other side. And I was like, oh, I remember why the 90s was in love with Gina Davis, because of things like this. And it's just like, she makes these two characters so distinct and so different. And I feel like that's always a challenge for any performer. And I love the way she does it in this movie.
Well, keep in mind, and to defend Ebert, and to be fair to Ebert,
to be fair,
this is 1996.
Mm-hmm.
In this era, we are 2 years after Pulp Fiction. You know, we've earlier in the year had From Dusk Till Dawn. Also this year, and I forget what release date this specifically had, but it was, I'm pretty sure it's after The Usual Suspects. We are smack dab in the middle of the indie boom.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a mainstream Hollywood movie that outruns fire. Like, there is, like, what he's talking about is there are these moments of Shane Black genius in here and greatness of Samuel L. Jackson's performance that then fall into the type of stuff that indie films were parodying. And he was done. This is, we're just a few, like, before this movie comes out, we're just a few months away from horror becoming meta. Like, it had become so tired that a movie was about to come out that would make fun of every horror movie that came out before it and would be a huge fucking hit. Like, that's where we are. 1996 is such a weird year for cinema, in which there was a huge rejection of what was happening in the mainstream and an embracing of what was happening on the fringes. And Ebert was no different. Like, I remember that year Joel Siegel talking about The Usual Suspects and saying, if I could build a time machine and go back in time and watch one movie over again, not knowing anything about it, it would be The Usual Suspects. And I was like, holy fuck, I gotta go watch that fucking movie. Oh my God. I saw that movie 3 times in a theater. That's what we're talking about, is we are in a renaissance of filmmaking that was rejecting this stuff, that people like Rennie Harlan were doing the type of stuff that we didn't want to see anymore. When I think about everything that goes wrong in the 90s, I always go back to Eraser. Like, Eraser's the movie that I'm like, this is what Hollywood was giving us while we were getting, you know, movies by Paul Thomas Anderson and Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez, and everybody's in the height of their career and at full fucking power. And everything is nuts, and we're seeing, you know, super crazy shit on the big screen that, you know, we were never given in our lifetime before. And this is, for Ebert, Eraser. It is that film that it's like, why am I watching this? There's so many other better films happening right now.
To him, it was a dinosaur.
It was a dinosaur. It was a relic of an era. It was an 80s movie made in the 90s. You know, he did not have at that moment, you know, the ability to look at it in terms of a large historical swath. He was seeing it as the stuff was coming out in a very revolutionary era. So I will give Ebert that. And assume that maybe if Ebert went back and revisited it, he would have gone, you know, there's a lot to this movie to like.
Yeah. Speaking of Rennie Harlan, apparently the ice skating scene, which I think is really fun. Like, it's a great, like, she takes down a car full of bad guys while ice skating, like, very wintertime. But again, like, a lot of the Christmas elements.
Well, the bad guys outside are frightful.
But the gunplay is so delightful.
And since they've got no place to go.
Let it snow!
So, oh, Joel Silver.
It was scripted to
end. You're no Abel Ferrar.
You're not, no. It was scripted to end with her performing a double axel flip and simultaneously firing over her upside down head. So basically, like, flipping around and doing a Tonya Harding move upside down and shooting at the same time. And they couldn't get the rigs
to work.
That's
all. Why did you? That's all a Tonya Harding move.
Right. Well, yeah. And taking people out. It's all a Tonya Harding move. But apparently they couldn't get the rig to work in sub-zero temperatures. So they had to excise it. But that would have been the most Rennie Harlan thing in the movie had they pulled
that
it off.
That would have been a little obnoxious.
Yeah. So, I mean, overall, I mean, just to kind of bring this to a close, because we've been jibber-jabbering about this movie for a while. I think there's so much about this.
I told you we wouldn't get through this fucking movie.
Yeah, there's so much about this movie that is so quintessentially Shane Black, and it's so fun to watch someone else try and play in his sandbox and not the other way around, because this really does feel like a situation where the director is directing to the screenwriter and not, you know, taking the script and doing their own thing with it necessarily.
Yeah, I feel like that's pure producer, because this is a Silver movie, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And Silver always has Shane's back.
Shane Black's back. That's hard to say.
He's got Black's back every time. But on top of that, imagine being the director working for a studio head that just paid $4 million for a script. You're filming that goddamn script.
Yeah, that's true.
You make your movie as long as everything on the page is fucking there.
I'm going to correct myself. Sheath your tweets. It's not actually Joel Silver. It's Mike DeLuca over at New Line.
Oh, it was DeLuca's movie.
Yeah, it was DeLuca who was kind of in the production.
So it's not Bob Shea.
It's not Bob Shea. It's Mike
DeLuca.
Yeah, I mean, 6-1.
That's where it was. Because DeLuca has beefs with a lot of people. Like DeLuca, here's a DeLuca story. I love this DeLuca story. DeLuca was a guy.
The more you say DeLuca, the more I think this story is going to end with him sleeping with the fishes.
Oh, no. Because DeLuca's still around. Like, he's a legend. But he was the guy who greenlit Magnolia, greenlit Little Nicky, you know.
Whoa, those are two very different films.
Oh, yes.
Wow. I got whiplash from those two films.
Yeah, except that both films were films that were very much films that the filmmakers wanted to make, and the end result was their film. Like, yeah, you might hate Little Nicky, you might love Magnolia, but those were both the directors going, this is the movie I want. And DeLuca backed that. And because that did so poorly, he was on the way out. They were giving him the boot. And he knew it. And so one of his last acts as the head of New Line was to greenlight the Lord of the Rings trilogy with a rubber stamp of no budget limitation.
Mm-hmm.
He gave Peter Jackson all the money in the world as a big fuck you to everybody else, but also knew that it would be good. And he left, and everyone's like, oh my God, the Lord of the Rings movies are going to be such a disaster.
Yeah.
And scene.
And we are, by the way, recording this episode on the 10th anniversary, or the 15th anniversary of the release of Return of the King. So, well,
there we go.
Bringing everything full circle.
It is, yeah, no, I mean, DeLuca has had more of an effect on your cinema watching than you even know. But yes, he also stepped on a lot of toes, butted a lot of heads, and he was clearly one of the guys that was, and I don't know who he was butting heads with at the time, but he and someone else were having it out, and that's what the story that Shane told me was, find two studio heads who hate each other so much that they will throw their company's resources at you just so the other person can't have it. And DeLuca won that fight with $4 million and then got the movie that, I mean, here's an interesting question. Where do you think this ranks in Black's oeuvre?
I would put this very high in Black's oeuvre. I mean, first and foremost, the thing we've never actually established is what is the best Shane Black period? Like, what is that movie? Like,
well, you know what we also haven't done? What's the best Tony Scott?
Yeah, no,
what's the best Ridley Scott?
But I'm saying,
like, this is,
as we're doing this series specifically on Shane Black, and we've covered a number of his movies in the past.
I know.
Have we ever definitively said what our favorite of his is? And I'm lumping into that writing, directing, or both. Like, everything from the Shane Black universe, what is the best one?
It's not easy.
It's not easy. I would say whatever number one is, this is two.
See, I would not do that. Like, for me, that's the thing, is I love this movie. First of all, I love virtually everything Shane's ever done. So, I mean, this is lower in Shane for me. Like, wow. I love this, but I love all of Shane. I mean, do I love this more than Monster Squad? No. Do I love this more than Kiss Kiss? No. Do I love this more than Nice Guys? No.
We
do
are
I love
arguing this about
more than Lethal Weapon? No.
We're arguing about the weight of several gold nuggets.
Exactly. That is, and that's my point of this, is there, I mean, I can only name one bad Shane Black movie that I don't want to cover on this show, and that's a movie that even Shane goes, yeah, that's not the movie that I wrote. Like, he'll own parts of it.
Is that the one I want to do?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but even Shane is like, yeah, no, that movie didn't come out the way we had hoped, and it's not the movie I wanted it to be, and enough was changed that it's not really my movie. Like, that's, you know, that is, that's the one that I can't hold against Shane, because once you're, when you're a screenwriter and somebody takes your script and then just does their own thing with it, the fuck are you going to do?
Yeah.
You can own it. You could be like, yeah, that movie wasn't as good. Yeah, I'm really not proud of that movie. You have to try not to throw other filmmakers under the bus and publicly say, yeah, by the way, the reason that movie's everything you guys keep asking for in the reviews, yeah, that's what I wrote. Because I wrote the movie you wanted to see, because I'm not a fucking moron. But how do you know? And I feel like that's very much what Last Action Hero is it's not the movie that he wanted to be. Like, I have nothing, I hold nothing against you for loving that movie, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. And I know that Shane isn't like, man, I wish more people liked that movie.
I still think, and I know we're not doing an episode on Last Action Hero right now, I still think the biggest problem with that movie is that it's the ultimate catch-22 for a concept, is that in order for that movie to work with audiences, you have to cast someone like Schwarzenegger who isn't in tune with the satire of what's going on. So what you effectively do is you create this great idea that only works if you cast someone who doesn't get it. And that's like, oh, like, talk about writing yourself into a corner.
I would argue that that's one of five problems that movie has. The other problem is there's this whole sequence in which they promise bringing in all these villains and having this huge villain cavalcade at the end, and they don't.
Yeah,
I mean, they promise, they grab your dick and fucking get you nice and hard with a hand job, and then it's like, oh yeah, hi, yeah, work just called, I gotta go. It's like, fuck. So what am I supposed to do now?
You've got cinematic blue balls.
You got cinematic blue balls. That movie has so many problems. And I can't blame Shane for them, because it's not the movie he wanted it to be. I mean, for fuck's sake, they spent $50 million putting the name of the movie on the side of a rocket that they shot into fucking space, because their heads were in the clouds with, we have Schwarzenegger and we have one of the biggest movies of the year.
Woo! Let's put it on a fucking rocket and send that bitch to space!
Did you not know that?
No, but that's awesome.
They spent $50 million advertising that movie by putting Last Action Hero on the side of a rocket they shot into space.
You might as well have
done. I'm not
Here's
shitting
what you should
you.
Have done.
I am not shitting you. That is really what fucking happened.
So you get a big hobo barrel and just throw all of that money in there while it's on fire. Like, what are you even talking about?
But you paint Last Action Hero on the side
of the
and
barrel.
No one cannot talk about it.
Dude, fucking awesome.
Boona Hobbit.
That brings us to the junk food pairing.
I hope so.
I guess. And I'm going to go with a pretty easy one for me.
This is like an hour and a half in, and we didn't even really talk about the movie.
I feel like we did. Finlandia vodka is what I'm going to go with. And specifically what you're going to do is you're going to drop it into a shot glass. You're going to roll it from the left side of your mouth. You're going to do the shot and roll it out the right in one fluid motion like Gina Davis does in this movie. And it's so fucking killer. I love that scene so much. And like, her interaction with him and the way he is at first like, who the fuck are you? But then immediately is hip to when she starts playing with him. He's like, no, I've seen this bit before. I know this hustle already. Like, no, that's not going to work with me. And they go through some shit where they're like, maybe we don't need to be a team. No, I actually do need you. And it's by the end of the movie, they're so simpatico that they're another great Shane Black team. And yeah, so it also, you know, Finland, obviously where Rennie Harlan is from, has to be represented in every Rennie Harlan movie. It's a great drink for the cold for Christmas time. Like, I'm thinking, yeah, drink yourself some vodka.
I'm torn here.
Yeah.
There are two really, like, that's, I won't disagree. However, I would argue if you're going to go with alcohol, maybe you go with a certain cognac.
Oh, a Hennessy, perhaps? Hennessy. That's not bad.
Having a Hennessy while watching Hennessy. I would also argue that a cherry pie might be appropriate.
Also very appropriate.
Or maybe a banana cream pie with a cherry swirl.
Oh, I like that.
If you're going to do something like that.
This is how we talk when we talk about pie for some reason.
We're going to talk about pie right now.
Guys, thank you so much for joining us for this very long episode. This long kiss goodnight about the long kiss goodnight.
It's really, yeah.
If and you will.
More and more scotch.
More scotch to come. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Massaworm, M-A-S-S-A-W-Y-R-M. You can find my new podcast with Dave Chen, Right Along Podcast, at rightalongpod.com. Or I think it's rightalongpodcast.com and then rightalongpod on Twitter, where every week I talk about new writing advice. You can also, hey, it's Christmas. Looking for something to get a family member? Why not pick up a copy of my book, Sea of Rust, or my movie, Doctor Strange, or Sinister? Send those fat 4 cent residuals my way.
Do that.
Well, I mean, really, 2 cents, because I'm a writing team.
you got to split that up.
I got to split that with my partner. But no, so that's where you can fucking find me.
Awesome.
That's where you can find me.
That's where you can find him. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. Of course, the show is at Junk Food Cinema. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/JunkFoodCinema. And if you really like the show...
I mean, you really like the show.
If you like the show more than New Line loves making bombs in 1996... Boy, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, and for as little as a dollar an episode, you get access to bonus content that no one else gets to hear, including coming up a whole episode on a little movie called Deadly Games that I am super
excited
about.
You are really excited,
about.
To talk about Deadly
Games. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited.
I'm shocked you missed that at Fantastic Fest.
I made a mistake, obviously. But for now, I'm going to end this episode mercifully, finally, and I'm going to remind you that this is the podcast that always tries to be frank and earnest with people.
In New York, I'm Frank.
And in Chicago, I'm Ernest.